Blog Talk Radio. Good afternoon. Today is Friday, June 21st, and welcome to another episode of Bear Benevolence. Did you know that lawmakers spend more time listening to the wealthy than anyone else? According to a June 12, 2013 article in Reuters, many politicians spend a significant amount of their day repping old school Wu-Tang. You know, cash rules everything around me. Cream get the money. Dollar bill, y'all. After all, campaign money is the lifeblood that keeps many of our lawmakers in office, from breakfast fundraisers to $500 per plate lunches that I never get invited to, but never mind, to sweaty call rooms reminiscent of telethons. It seems that appealing to the concerns of the haves overshadows much of the needs of the have-nots. Which begs the question, if this is how it works in the political arena, how influential are the haves in pushing their agendas in the charitable sector? You see, like politicians, nonprofits are at the mercy of philanthropists. A cursory look at any foundation website will reveal phrases like giving priorities, what we fund, and grant-making guidelines. While the positive intentions of grantmakers may indeed be sincere, the power dynamic is incredibly obvious. This holds true both in deciding which issues to fund and the best ways to fund them. Case in point, funder listening sessions. On June 22, 2011, the U.S. Department of Labor's Employment and Training Administration, ETA for short, held a conference call with foundations to get their input on the development of a new workforce innovation fund. Hosted in collaboration with the Council on Foundations, a.k.a. the mother of all grant-making membership associations, this call was designed to gather intel on how to improve service delivery and outcomes for the public workforce system. How will best practice information be gathered, you may be asking? By talking to foundations and getting their feedback on which practices will ultimately improve services for America's workers and employers. If you're a fundraiser, this may be great news because it means, yes, foundations do in fact read your long, drawn-out, year-end grant reports. Sarcasm aside, though, I do believe that foundations possess a wealth of knowledge when it comes to evaluating which programs and services have the greatest impact on a given issue. But somehow, I'm left wondering, why didn't the ETA simply reach out to workers and employers directly? Are they not in a better position to articulate those strategies and policies that work for and are against their best interests? The answer is a perplexing one indeed. Rob Reich, Associate Professor of Political Science at Stanford University, said it best in a forum discussion in the March-April 2013 issue of Boston Review magazine. In a discussion titled, What Are Foundations For?, Mr. Reich shared this viewpoint. He wrote, quote, as a general matter, grant seekers are supplicants. Exaggerating only slightly, I found that people who become foundation officers are often surprised to find themselves transformed into the smartest and best-looking people in a room. End quote. It seems the power dynamic that exists between foundations and nonprofits is the proverbial 800-pound gorilla in the room. But has philanthropy always been this way? As is commonly known, religion was the impetus for modern-day philanthropy, especially in America. Whether opening schools for freed slaves, to efforts to aid the tired, poor, the huddled masses yearning to breathe free, blah, blah. Charitable acts were rooted for many in a deep sense of moral obligation. Basically, your willingness to help those less fortunate or not was a matter strictly between you and the Creator. The system of financial compensation for charitable deeds in the form of tax breaks did not appear on the scene until the first part of the 20th century. In 1917, Congress passed the War Revenue Act, which increased personal income taxes to fund World War I. This act also established what we now know as a charitable deduction, the standard amount that individuals and married couples could subtract from their total income when filing taxes. Now, instead of just giving to charities out of your own sense of moral obligation, the government has created an additional incentive in the form of lesser taxes, i.e., money, to spur philanthropic efforts. For private foundations, the incentive came in the form of the Tax Reform Act of 1969, which mandated that these grantmakers distribute a minimum percentage of their investment assets for charitable and administrative purposes. This was done to limit the prevalence of foundations as tax shelters for the wealthy, which was happening a lot during that time. Now known as the 5% payout rule, many foundations can simply fulfill much of the 5% threshold by hiring foundation staff. After all, administrative things cost, and they count, right? While this rule seems brilliant on the surface, foundations and the people who run them are still disproportionately benefiting from the system of philanthropy. It's ironic. For example, the median average salary for foundation CEOs was $150,000, and 21% received a bonus, according to the Council on Foundations 2010 Grantmakers Salary and Benefits Report. Even in foundations that are considered small, meaning those who have only one full-time staff member, the median salary in 2010 was approximately $82,000. With respect to benefits, nearly all foundations offered voluntary benefits to their staff. Over half funded the full cost of medical benefits, and 9 out of 10 foundations offered a retirement/pension plan for their employees. Now, I don't know about you, but I have never, ever worked in a nonprofit nor heard of one that provided such luscious retention packages. In fact, the popular assumption is that if you work for a nonprofit, you're probably not making any money. Unfortunately, there is a lot of truth to that, though, because while foundations were securing the financial status of their employees over the years, their grant making did not mirror the same increase. According to the Giving USA 2012 report, foundation grant making amounted to 14% of all gifts given in 2011. This is the same proportion of giving that they gave in 2010. There's no increase in their grants, but their staff are on the come up. I guess the rising tide does not lift all boats after all. As Mr. Reich wrote in the same Boston Review article, quote, "Foundations are virtually by definition the voice of plutocracy. The assets of a modern philanthropic foundation are set aside in a permanent, donor-directed, tax-advantaged private endowment and distributed for a public purpose. These considerable private assets give it considerable public power. And with growing wealth and income inequality, their apparent tension, with democratic principles only intensifies." End quote. Bill Domhoff, sociology research professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and author of Who Rules America? The Triumph of the Corporate Rich, provides a more direct explanation of how wealth influences philanthropy. He writes, quote, Wealth can be seen as a resource that is very useful in exercising power. Now, that's obvious when you think of donations to political parties, payments to lobbyists, and grants to experts who are employed to think up new policies beneficial to the wealthy. Wealth also can be useful in shaping the general social environment to the benefit of the wealthy, whether through hiring public relations firms or donating money for universities, museums, music halls, and art galleries. End quote. What does this mean for nonprofits, you may be wondering? It means that those with wealth, whether foundations or individuals, are in a unique position to do two things. One, give money to shape social policies that ultimately benefit their needs and desires. And two, give more money to then monitor society's response to inequities that surface as a result of such policies. Basically, they're in control. Let me be clear. I am in no way a conspiracy theorist. I frankly don't think that our country's 1% is clever enough to single-handedly oppress the 99% that is the rest of us. However, I'm a realist, and I believe that knowledge is power. As with any business, nonprofits should understand the lay of the land. This includes fully acknowledging the complexities that exist when seeking money from the wealthy. This also demands that nonprofits spend less time focusing solely on the so-called major donors. If 73% of all donations come from individuals, why not spend energy cultivating those who give repeatedly, no matter the dollar amount? These are the donors that will maintain your work in the long run. As Simone Jawayot, fund development expert and fellow Michigan State alumni, recently stated, enough with the rich. Find people who care about the cause. Well, folks, that's all the time I have for today. If you would like to keep the conversation going, go ahead and share this podcast with your friends on Twitter and Facebook. You can also contact me directly through my website at TamarCloydConsults.weebly.com. Free fundraising tips are also at your disposal when you subscribe to my monthly blog at fundtimes.wordpress.com. As always, thanks for listening. Cheers.